Good morning, everybody.
Oh, one more question for you.
I have one.
How much do you need? How long do you want to do it?
Of course, it's a tire.
So,
Okay. Okay, great.
Okay, so good morning. The first thing I'd like to do is invite all those sitting in the back row to come and sit in the nice empty front row. Unless you really have such a personality that you have created a third row for yourself. In which case, you're allowed to move up to the second row. Because we've been trying to create community and we psychologically design the rooms so people will move forward, because I know we all like to sit in the back.
Okay.
So we're covering your product. Have a minor temporary. You're loud. Okay, if you need a table, that's fine. Okay.
All right. Okay.
I only get to wield this kind of power for another half an hour.
So, just to go over the schedule for today, after the interview with Robert M. Doran, we're going to have a break, and then Mark Miller's paper, and then after that, we're going to acknowledge the wonderful people who put this thing together, with all the food and everything, and then we're going to have a liturgy, and then lunch. We're going to just finish up the leftovers, so I'm not sure how much there is, but you're all more than welcome to finish it. And there's also some questionnaires back there. So a questionnaire like a kind of, what is that?
May I make a suggestion about the questionnaire? That,
yeah.
That there'd be a bouncer at the door and no one gets to leave. Shoot bouncer.
Okay, great. So that's it. That's the kind of schedule. And did I miss anything there?
I don't think so. The way that the interview with Father Dora will work is we will talk for half an hour, and then I'm going to open up the floor for questions. If you guys have any particular questions, the issues that we talk about here. If you have questions for clarification, but also if you've read Father Doran's work and you have a particular question that you're interested in there, then you're welcome to ask that too. Am I right with that? Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
I'd also like to acknowledge a new member of our group, Professor John Daniel Dabowski, straight from the Far East. Come to join us. Nice to see you, John. So just to introduce our interviewer and interviewee, Dorothy Cummings. I've been told, well, I knew this, but she reminded me that she's the aunt of what's
Jacob.
Jacob.
Yeah.
A little boy.
Yeah.
He's 2 years old.
Yeah.
And you have two brothers and two sisters.
That's right.
I'm gonna meet your brother later today.
Yeah.
And Professor Bob Doran, who is the Emmett Doerr Chair in Catholic Systematic Theology at Marquette University. And I've just learned that Bob is a big Brewers fan, so it's kind of nice. He's going back to his favorite ball team. So with no further ado...
He's written a few books.
Oh, yeah. He's actually quite a significant person in the field of theology. But he likes the Brewers, too.
If you run out of theological questions, I can talk about the Brewers.
Yeah, it's the first conference in which the Brewers thing has happened, so I'm very proud of that. Okay, so Bob, what we know you for at Regis is a really great professor, but what you are known for is your work linking psychology and theology. So could you tell us why you decided to study psychology and theology? How did that come about?
Yeah, it's a long history here, but I'll try to keep it, I'll try to make it clear. It was an interest that developed for me when I was a Jesuit novice. So that was from 1956 to 1958. Being introduced to the spiritual life through the exercises of St. Ignatius Loyola. But I developed a tremendous interest in the interface between psychology and spirituality at that time. And we had a novice master who, while he was not an academic, was a profoundly spiritual person and a person to whom you could open your soul with tremendous confidence and trust. And I think he's, to this day, the most wonderful human being that I've ever met, Father Joseph Sheehan. And I was able to tell him just about everything about myself. In trust and so on. And he had, while he wasn't professionally trained in psychology, he had done a large amount of reading in this area, and he was able to work through that and relate it to the spiritual life and the exercises and so on in ways that were very integrated and holistic. And so this was an interest that developed for me at that time. And after my juniorate studies, 59 to 60, I had given some thought to the possibility of eventually studying medicine and being a psychiatrist. That faded over time because I developed other interests, but when I went to St. Louis University and where I did the bulk of my undergraduate studies, I was originally a psychology major. And I probably did about 18 credits towards a bachelor's degree in psychology, so roughly half of what would be required to get a bachelor's degree in psychology, before I realized that where my interests were really lying at that time was in philosophy itself. And so I switched and became a philosophy major, but the interest perdured. The reason for the switch was that the psychology was, and this was even at a Christian and Catholic university, the psychology department was largely behaviorist, and I wasn't interested in that sort of, you know, stimulus response kind of thing with no interiority at all. That didn't interest me in the least. And there was only one or two professors who even spoke about those psychological figures who did explore interiority, for instance, Freud and Jung, who were definitely into interiority. As Lonergan says, Freud, for all of the waywardness of his thinking and the reductionism and so on, his great discovery is psychogenic disease. That there is disease that is psychological in its origins, and not physical in its origins, but psychological, traumatic psychological experiences. So I switched to philosophy because we had, the philosophy that we were taught in St. Louis was the best of the Gilsonian type of Thomist thinking. The people were trained under Etienne Gilson here in Toronto. Almost all of our professors were his students. And while I always resisted the starting point of the philosophy, we got a consistent presentation of Thomism, a lot of which was quite accurate. I mean, the metaphysics that we were taught was Thomas's metaphysics, and it wasn't a conceptualistic or essentialist distortion of that metaphysics, but it was the existential metaphysics of Thomas with emphasis on the active existence and so on. But at any rate, there was a systematic framework that was provided for us in that education, which was something that I was looking for and was not finding in psychology. Okay, to jump over a few years, when I was first ordained in 1969, I was a doctoral student in theology at Marquette University, starting a doctoral program in the year that I was ordained. I was ordained in June of 69, began studies in the fall of 69 at Marquette in theology. But within the first year, I started making a lot of pastoral contacts with the students at Marquette. And there was a paper that was written by the academic vice president of the university. There was a lot of conflict about what does it mean to have a Catholic university. And the vice president, academic vice president, was the head of this commission to review the Catholic character of the university, and he put together a very solid paper on Marquette as a Catholic university, but one of the recommendations was that there needed to be formed a campus ministry program. At that time, there was only one person engaged in ministry, in pastoral ministry to a student body of 12,000 people. So, and they just figured, well, there's a Jesuit community here, so we don't really need that. Well, they do need it. And so I was asked to be the first director of campus ministry at Marquette and to interrupt my doctoral studies for 2 years to get this program off the ground. And I did that, but it was at great personal cost to me because I was young. This was at the time when there was a great deal of tension in the church. It was right after Vatican II. There were the liberals and the conservatives in the Jesuit community. There were the liberals and the conservatives, and I was trying to walk a middle line there, but I was getting flack from both sides. And it was the time of, we began making our presence felt on the campus, even before the campus ministry started officially, at the time of the Kent State riots.
Now when you say we, you mean campus ministry?
The campus ministry, and this was the first thing that we did, was to mount a response on the part of the Christian, the gospel, to this. And there was Students for a Democratic Society, which was a basically Marxist group. I had some friends in that group, but they were not faith motivated for the most part. Their response, they were surprised to see us get out the same morning with our leaflets, sponsoring prayer and liturgy and social action around these matters, whereas they were also doing the same thing. And then we started to negotiate to see if we could work together on some things and so forth. But it was an extremely tense environment. The president of the university, God bless him for all of his wonderful things, and he did great things for the university, was threatened by the fact that we took an anti-war position. I got into a lot of trouble with him over that because benefactors were not happy that the campus ministry was expressing an anti-war position and so on. The upshot of it was that by the time I was finished with that job, I needed to see a clinical psychologist for a while, and because it just the upset of all of it. So I was lucky enough to end up with a person. I spent 18 months seeing him, perhaps three times a month. He was not an official Jungian analyst, thank God, but he was trained in Jungian psychology and was able to sift out what is positional, if you want, he sort of knew this, and he worked with me. And at that point in my life, this is not the case now, but at that point in my life, I was having extremely significant dreams. My dream life was very alive, and so it was a very fortunate set of circumstances that led me to this whole new exploration. I had gotten into Lonergan in 1967, before this, and what I realized through this process was I was now exploring a very different region of interiority from the one that Lonergan has us explore, namely cognitional operations, intentional operations. This is different. This is that whole realm of affect, feeling, symbol, and so on. And while it can be integrated with Lonergan, and while I think especially in method and theology, he opens all the doors to the integration, as he himself says, the room is there, but I didn't furnish it.
Isn't there traditionally kind of a tension between psychology, Freudian and Jungian analysis, and Roman Catholicism,
yeah.
Or this is Sabbath religion at all?
No, this is what I found, because I get very excited about Jungian psychology at this time, and decided that I was going to do my dissertation trying to work on this integration of Lonergan and Jung, but went to the Jung Institute in Zurich to try to write the dissertation there. I wanted to be in the environment where Carl Jung was, where he had taught, and where his students were still teaching. And I discovered there that there is an ultimate incompatibility. If you can't be a full-fledged Jungian, you can take things from Jung, as my therapist did, fantastic, because he is much more open to the transcendent and so on than Freud is. There's no question about that. But ultimately, his position on Jung his position on God and his position on good and evil are counterpositional in terms of anything Catholic and Ignatian, and particularly Ignatian. And I realized that the spiritual exercises and Orthodox Jungianism are not compatible with one another. That in the spiritual exercise, you reach the two standards, for instance, in the second week of the spiritual exercise, you must make a choice between what Ignatius calls the way of Christ and the way of Satan. You have to choose between them.
Yeah.
They cannot be integrated.
And Jung has the idea you're supposed to make peace with the other side.
That's right. And I saw people on the students, including priests, in the training program, they're training to become Jungian analysts who were attempting what Jung wanted them to do, and I thought they were ruining their lives. I thought it was self-destructive. Yeah. So this is where I took an independent stance, and I realized then that I could not become a Jungian analyst. When I went over there, one of the possibilities was that I would stay there, and my province supported this. If I decided that I wanted to do this, they would have funded me through it to become a Jungian analyst, but I realized, no, I can't do that. I have to go an independent route, and what I want to do is to try now this integration in a way that is compatible with Catholic doctrine, with the spiritual exercise, with Ignatius, and so on. And the way into that is to say, all right, where we must begin is with the structure of interiority as it's been provided to us by Lonergan. Mm-hmm. And then, with that, and with all the openings that he has in method about where feelings and symbols and so on are part of our interior lives, to integrate this into that. And so that's what I did in the dissertation first, and then subsequently in Psychic Conversion and Theological Foundations, and then it reaches, I think, its greatest integration in theology and the dialects of history, where that integration really of intentionality and psyche grounds the whole book, because it grounds the three dialectical processes. They're basically rooted in intentionality and psyche. So there's practical intelligence and intersubjectivity. That's intentionality and psyche. There's anthropological and cosmological. It's intentionality and psyche. And then in the dialectic of the subject, it is intentionality and psyche.
Now, I definitely want to touch on psychic conversion. But first, I think you said you started reading Lonergan in 1967?
Yeah.
And how did that come about?
I had the book, Insight. I bought it in 1962. Hardcover for $5 at the St. Louis University bookstore. And I tried to crack it 5 times. And I did okay in math in high school, but in college, my interests weren't there, so I only had one math course in college, you know. So I lost all of that. And then you start Insight. Well, the definition of the circle, that was no problem. But after that, there were a lot of problems. And I didn't know, you know, I mean, I had a sense. But what I knew was from the preface and the introduction, I knew that he was doing what I wanted and what I had been looking for. And so I just, in 67, the dean of the School of Philosophy and Letters, which was the Jesuit seminary in St. Louis, he asked me to teach the course for the Scholastics and Metaphysics over a full year, a 2-semester course. And I just made up my mind, I am not going to teach the metaphysics or the approach to metaphysics that I was taught, because it relies on naive realism. So I said, okay, this time I'm gonna read the whole of Insight, no matter what happens. So I started in the summer of 67, and I read the whole book through the course of 3 months. I got through the whole book, and by the time I got to chapter 7, I was hooked. The dialectic of community and the biases and Cosmopolis, I said, this is it. So, and that, I got it. And I got, basically I got it, even though I still had a lot of struggle with classical and statistical heuristic structures and all of that in the first 5 chapters. So I taught metaphysics from a Lonergan standpoint in 1967-68. And I didn't meet him until the summer of 1968, the year after that, at Boston College, when he was there as part of a 3-week institute on method in religious studies. So he was the last of the speakers. Bill Richardson spoke about Heidegger and Bultmann. Mircea Eliade on history of religions, a method in the history of religion. Father Davamoni from the Gregorian University on interreligious studies. And then somebody in Donald Evans, who was here at the University of Toronto, at that time, who at that time was a very orthodox linguistic analyst. He moved far beyond that position, but that's where he was at that time. He gave us an analytic approach. And then what really impressed me in that was that the only one of those five speakers who went to everybody else's lectures was Bernard Lonergan. Mm-hmm. He was at all of them. And the others just came, did their own thing, and left. But he was there at the beginning, even though he was going to be the last of the speakers. He went to everybody's lectures. And he wanted to hear what they were saying, and he wanted to, as much as possible, be ready to integrate and what he was saying with what others had said in this institute to try to pull it together. This was a wonderful thing about him. This is a funny story, and I hope I'm not but it's the same characteristic in him. In 1970 in St. Louis, there was a meeting on, it was a conference on the Jesuit as priest and apostle. And that's where Lonergan was invited to give the first of the lectures, which is the Jesuit as priest and apostle in the modern world. It's in the second collection. That's the lecture that he gave. Well, first of all, he started out his lecture, we're sitting there on Friday night, and he gets up there. I will treat my topic under the following six headings. And the person, the Jesuit, that's sitting next to me said, oh God, here we go. But he covered scripture. Like the whole three first sections are on scripture. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I should be telling this or not, but it indicates the thing with him. Somebody said to him afterwards, well, now why? We appreciate the scripture, and it was very good, and so on. But that's not your field. Why did you do so much work on this in scripture? And he said, well, you know, John McKenzie was also on the program. John L. McKenzie. And John L. McKenzie was a great Old Testament scholar. He wrote that dictionary of the Old Testament or whatever. Fantastic. But in those days, whenever you got John McKenzie speaking, what you heard was his problems with the contemporary church. You didn't hear his scriptural. And Lonergan said, I suspected that he probably would not do too much on scripture, so I thought that I should. Anyway.
Well, about that, the fact that Lonergan was talking about scripture, we often forget that Lonergan was Father Lonergan. And because I've never heard anyone discuss this before, what was Lonergan like as a priest?
I know that, I think we're, if you want to find it in his writings, the next volume, not the immediate next volume, but the one that's coming right after that in the collected works called Shorter Papers, will, a number of these things are his devotional works that he wrote in the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. On the Mass, on the mystical body of Christ, on human suffering, this war, his review of Carol Hauslander's book, This War is the Passion. And you get the sense of the pastoral motivation behind his work. I think his whole work is motivated by a pastoral concern for the reign of God in the world. I know that he did a great deal of work quietly when he was a younger priest in Montreal and in Toronto with instructing people in the faith. But he was a priest scholar, and he definitely was geared in this direction, and he had problems with, he would not be the kind of professor who would spend his weekends going around to parishes, because he needed the time to do his work. So whatever he did as a priest was integrated with the work that he was doing as a professor. But he was a priest.
And as a professor?
As a professor. I didn't have him as a professor. I found him a very exciting and stimulating lecturer. Like in Boston, the second lecture that he gave was the first time that he went public with functional specialties. Mm-hmm. So the atmosphere in the group was electric, because we knew that this was a fantastic insight, that it pulled together the whole discipline of theology. It mapped everything. and all of us have been struggling with how is exegesis related to dogma. All of us, man, he did it. And we walk out of there, Bernie Tyrrell, if you know Bernie Tyrrell, walk out of there, literally pulling his hair and saying, if he ever says it's all straw, I'll kill myself. But it is so exciting. It really was exciting, you know. So, and there, but I know in Rome that, you know, there were mixed reviews of him as a professor because he aimed high, you know. And so the Trinity, the volume on the Trinity that we're coming out with next, the Deutrino Pars Systematica, the Triune God Systematics, it is an extraordinarily technical work. I think it's one of the greatest works of pure systematic theology that has ever been written. But it's, and this was what he was teaching.
Yeah.
I mean, it, but he had classes of 500 and 600 people. Well, that's the way it was in those days. Now, how many of them followed the thing all the way through? I don't know. I'm not sure.
And one thought I was having, just thinking about Lonergan in Rome, I think you told us that Lonergan, what Lonergan really wanted to do was bring a historical sense to theology.
Yeah, he said that.
Okay, so I would really like to situate Lonergan in history himself, since he was a man of the 20th century. I'm wondering what effect the World Wars had on him, the Depression, the turmoil of the 60s, the super turmoil within Catholic theology, including at Regis College in the 1970s.
Good question. His first major intellectual interest was, as far as I'm able to trace, now, Bill Matthews' book, I think he may take, I'm not sure, but he may take a somewhat different view on this or not from what I'm going to say right now. The first thing that really grabbed Lonergan as in his interest was definitely, I think, the questions around epistemology. And this was, so the kind of thing that we're most familiar with. But that didn't last as the major interest for too long. Like in the 30s, what emerges is an interest in the philosophy first and then theology of history. And the Depression sparking an interest. The Depression sparked the interest in economics. And the things that he wrote in the 1930s, most of which haven't been published yet, or some of them now have been published in Method, but they'll be published in a separate volume of archival materials, are around the problem of history and the philosophy of history. And then he started to work on economics in the early 40s, but it was in response to the Depression.
And he spent the Depression in Montreal?
He spent the Depression, part of it in Montreal and part of it in Rome.
Okay, so he must have been in Rome then with the rise of National Socialism.
Yes.
And then fascism in Italy.
Yes.
Did he ever discuss what it was like?
He just got out of Rome before the war broke. He had not finished his dissertation. He was planning to stay there and finish and defend the dissertation. And then he just got on the boat before Italy was caught up in the war. You'll find his views on this again in this volume, Shorter Papers, because he's reviewing books that are dealing with the rise of National Socialism, and in the essays on the philosophy of history that he wrote in the 30s, there are comments on both National Socialism and Bolshevism, as he calls it, or Soviet communism and totalitarianism. This was part of what gripped me in my reading of Insight in 1967 was in chapter 7 of Insight. He's very much addressing questions about how societies move to totalitarian positions. So all of that, he experienced that when he was in that movement as it was happening in Italy in the late 30s. He was there for the whole, from 36 to 40, except for his tertianship, which is in France, from 36 to 41.
Okay, so he was at the Gregorian at this time.
Gregorian, yeah.
So I imagine the students were divided over there, for or against fascism in Italy.
Yeah, probably. Now, I don't know that. I don't know that he ever commented on that. He did write a short piece, and we only have part of it preserved, on the national mentalities of Europe. And so he's sort of trying to say what differentiates the French from the Germans from the British and so forth in terms of their... but it's sketchy, it's fragments that we have on that. And, but he wrote it during that period. I don't know if that gives a sufficient feeling for it, but in the late 30s, he wrote to his provincial in Canada and said, you know, what I really want to do is the philosophy of history. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to do with my life. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't at that point epistemology and cognitional theory, epistemology and metaphysics, those remained interests, but he didn't really discover Thomas until 1936 and all. Mm-hmm. His philosophical studies in Heathrow claimed to be Thomistic, but they were really Suarezian, and it was conceptualism and essentialism, and he resisted it. And in his own mind, Thomas was associated with that rather than with his real position. And he didn't discover it until he realized that if you need to the real distinction between essence and existence if you are going to give a theological presentation of the dogma of the hypostatic union. Mm-hmm. That so you've got the word and the existence of the word. The central act of existence is the act of existence of the divine word, and then nature, two natures, essence. Mm-hmm. And you need the distinction. If you don't have the distinction, then you've got a monophysitism. Existence and essence are one. So that's where he became a Thomist. His theological studies.
I just have time for one last question. Ooh, but I'm going to ask you about the 70s later. If anybody has a question about the 70s, I'll be grateful. One thing I'm interested in, is there something about Lonergan that people neglect or misunderstand that troubles you, that you would like to clear up?
I guess two things. I think from the right, from the Catholic right, there are still people who suspect that he's an idealist and that he's Kantian. And he isn't. I mean, that's clear. And I point them to the first essay by Giovanni Sala in Lonergan and Kant. That's all they need to do. And Sala is a respected Kant scholar. So there's nothing fake about that article. But if you want to know the difference between Lonergan and Kant, just read the first of those papers in that book and you've got it. That he is not Kantian. But there's this thing, as they told us in St. Louis, with respect to this whole approach, once you go in, you'll never get out. You know? And so if you start with interiority, you never get to the real world. Well, that's naive realism. You know? That's all that there is to it. And the other thing, and it also has to do with that, well, it's misconceptions from both sides, I guess, in terms of divisions within the church. The right would like to get Lonergan, but they can't. And it infuriates them because they know that he's Orthodox. They can't get him on dogma.
Yeah.
And they never will be able to. Trinity, Christ, Mary, I mean, one of his first theological pieces is on the Assumption. You know? They can't get him on any of that stuff. And so it frustrates them, you know, because there are other things in his work that are threatening. In terms of the church as a historical process of self-constitution, there's a lot of things that can change, and they change by the creative process of experiencing, understanding, judging, and deciding. And this is threatening. From the other side, I think there are people who the very fact that he is dogmatically orthodox, who want to open up things that Lonergan, and this gets into the theological turmoil of the 70s. I think it's a bit of a response to this. He was very upset by the dogmatic. I saw this in conversations, the denial of the resurrection and the divinity of Christ and the Trinity in Catholic theology. Mm-hmm. And a part of Catholic theologians. He was very upset by that, as was Karl Rahner. And that doesn't place either one of them in an extremely right-wing position. It just it says they were both orthodox when it comes to doctrine and dogma. You know, but he was very upset by that. And,
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Bob. And I'd like to invite people who have questions.
I'd actually like to start off. Bob, you became friends with Lonergan, I guess, later in his life. Could you just talk about that a little bit, like
sure.
how your friendship developed and what that was?
Yeah. Well, as I said, I met him for the first time in 1968. And, you know, I was there talking with another Jesuit scholastic, Gary Scober, and Gary knew Bernie, and Bernie knew him. So this man comes up. I had seen pictures of Lonergan. There was one picture that was the only picture that you saw, was the one, have you seen the picture where he's got a Roman collar on and he's holding Insight in his hand? Well, that was the only picture that I saw, and it really was, it didn't really look like Lonergan. I mean, I didn't know that when I saw the picture, because it looked from the picture, for instance, like his hair was gray. His hair never turned gray in all his life. He didn't have a lot of hair by the end of his life, but it never turned gray. So this man comes up, he's wearing a Roman collar, and he knows Gary Scoberg, and he introduces him, shakes his hand, but he didn't say who he was. And then I introduced myself, Bob Doran, and he shook my hand, but he didn't say who he was. And he stood there for a few minutes, and they had to joke with Gary, and then he walked away. And I turned to Gary, and I said, who's that? And he said, that's him. And I tried to put that face together with what I had seen in the picture, and it really was a surprise to me. Okay. Anyway, I just had more or less superficial contact with him during those 3 weeks. We went off, a whole bunch of us went to a Jesuit village for a weekend and enjoyed each other's company and so on. But it was in 73 when I had reached this notion of psychic conversion, and I was starting to work on the dissertation, that I decided to come to Toronto, and Regis was still in Willowdale on Mayview Avenue, to spend some time in his presence to get his feedback on what I was doing. So when I got there, he was preparing the Larkin Stewart lectures at Trinity College. And so I didn't want to bother him. It was very obvious that he was caught up in writing these lectures. So I just laid low for a while. But it was actually one of the lectures, Sacralization and Secularization, that sparked for me. There were some things that he said in there about symbol and symbolic mentalities and so on that sparked it for me. And it was a good thing that I waited, because what I was able to do was to put together on about 3 pages, 25 statements, 25 theses. So I didn't want to give him like this huge thing to read. So I put these together, and I went up and I put them in his, he was living on the 6th floor out there, and there was a mailbox outside his door, and I dropped it in there, because he wasn't, I knocked on his door and he wasn't there. And then I went into the father's recreation room, and he was there playing solitaire, which he did for a break, you know, gave him a, and I said, I just dropped something in your mailbox, so it's not long, and when you have a chance, would you look at it and tell me what you think? And he said, sure. So 45 minutes later, he's back in my room. So he comes in, and he says, and now I don't want to sound self-promoting here, but if you want the story, he typed 2 statements. I asked him 2 questions with the I had a little note. I have 2 questions. Have I understood you correctly? And what do you think about what I'm saying on my own? So he typed his answers at the top of the 25 theses, and he had already made a photocopy for himself. One, yes, you have understood me correctly. 2, you are making a necessary contribution to my work. So then. And then, so he came down to my room, and he said, he handed this back to me. And he said, I can't do this. I don't know this well. You know, I mean, he said, I have feelings and I have dreams, but I have not done a systematic exploration of it. But it has to be done. And then he said, I want to see everything you write from this point on. So that's when we became friends. So I did. I sent him everything. And then after I moved to Toronto, he called me after I was here for a couple of months, and he said, I'm rewriting my will, and I want, at that point, Fred Crow was the only executor of his estate, and he said, I want to appoint 3 executors for security's sake, and I want one of them to be younger, and I want it to be somebody who is committed enough to my work, who will keep it alive. So would you be one of those executors? So I was happy to do that. But also, it was kind of overwhelming experience to be asked that. But then, when he moved back to Toronto and went to the infirmary, I visited him weekly. Well, I wasn't here when he came back. I was down in Milwaukee for some kind of a meeting. But when I got back, it was right after Christmas, and I went up there on January 1st. And I said to him then, every weekend that I'm in Toronto, I will come out to see you. And so I did. And for the first 6 months or so, he was quite lucid. And we had some very good conversations and some great stories, wonderful things. And then he became increasingly sick and so on. But there were a couple of things that were very moving when you're talking about how there's a lucidity that even people whose minds are they're losing, but still there was an occasional lucidity. And about a week, I think it was a week before he died, when I was visiting him, he said to me, you promised me that you would visit me weekly, and you have been faithful to your promise. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So, and then the night before he died, I had already visited him. And then his brother, Greg, who was a Jesuit, who was also at the Jesuit infirmary, but in better, much better health at that time than Bernie, said to me, after I visited him, he said, have you told him about the collective works? And I said, well, no, because we haven't signed the contract yet. We're still negotiating. And he said, well, you know it's going to happen, don't you? And I said, yeah, it's going to happen. He said, tell him, because he's not going to live much longer. You've got to tell him. So I went back in, and I just said, Bernie, there's one more thing that I want to tell you. The University of Toronto Press is going to publish the collected works of Bernie Lonergan. And this tiny, tiny, tiny little smile came on his face, and he said, good for them. And that was it, you know? That was, and then he died the next morning. So.
That's great. Who's the third executor of the...
Terry Walsh, former provincial of the Upper Canada province. Now, Fred has resigned as... there's actually two terms now. There's this is subsequent to that. His will specifies 3 trustees. The Government of Canada, and for copyright purposes, wants 1 executor. There could be as many trustees of the estate, but 1 is an executor. And that was Fred Crow, it's now me, for copyright purposes, recognized by the Government of Canada. But the 3 executors now are myself, the 3 trustees of the estate are myself, Terry Walsh, and Gordon Rickson. Fred resigned from that when he moved out to Pickering.
Okay,
sure.
Bob, I'd just like to focus a little bit about your own work, especially your work in theology and dialectics of history. And I was just wondering, have you had a chance to go a little further regarding the dialectic of culture?
Not too much.
That's a rather innovative piece.
Yeah, it is my own. I mean, I know that obviously the dialectic of community and the dialectic of subject are taken directly out of chapter 7 of Insight, but the scale of values, if the social level is a dialectic of community, and the personal level is, well, in between the personal and the social, there's this culture, and does that have an analogous dialectical structure? And it was Eric Vogelin's suggestions at the beginning of Israel and Revelation that there are the the cosmological societies, and then in Greece you have the emergence of the anthropological, and Vogelin's got a brilliant analysis of the difference between the two. The cosmological is the social is first, and the individual fits in, and so on. So, so I said, well, that's a dialect of culture. You know, and it's the cosmological is psychic in its roots, and the anthropological is intentional in its roots. And so it's the same basis for it. Now, Neil Ormerod just sent me, he's been working with my stuff for a long time, as you probably know, and he's been a very good friend. He just sent me something. And he said what helps him get it, but I haven't had a chance to reflect on it yet, but he said what helps him get a hold of this dialectic of culture is to think of it in terms of tradition-bound societies societies that are on the move forward. Well, that works and it doesn't, I think. I'm not sure yet. I have to think more about it, and I really have to read more than simply what he sent me in his email, because you can have a very tradition-bound society that is purely anthropological, but classicist, for instance, you know, but the classicist mentality is anthropological, but it's stuck in a certain. But this is the only; these are the only values, you know, the values of this particular culture. But classicism is basically Greek and Roman in its origins, and that's anthropological more than cosmological. So I'm not sure yet about that.
Your principle of our synthesis, though, was a kind of soteriological.
That's right, and I think that still works. You know, although I think it really needs to be developed, because we need a contemporary soteriology that is relevant to our contemporary culture. And when I'm suggesting that the soteriological, that the authentic preaching of the gospel, will mediate what is of value from both of these mentalities, I'm partly thinking of the inconvenient truth of the ecological crisis, you know, that is one of the strengths of the cosmological, is this sympathy and harmony with the rhythms and processes of human nature. That's what must be preserved from the cosmological mentality. And today, the preaching of the gospel has got to call us back as stewards of creation to that harmony that is found in the indigenous cultures, for instance, with the rhythms and processes of non-human nature. Jung used to tell the story about Navajo. I think it was Navajo. He visited Arizona and Navajo, but that white people would continue to try to build a settlement in a region of Arizona that the Indians, whatever religious significance they gave to it, whether it was accurate or not, they said human beings can't live in that. We know that. No, but they can't live there. And there would always be some kind of natural disaster that would wipe out these white settlements. But they had this, it was their contact with the way the winds blew and the way the earth was that this was not a place to try to live. Well, we need that from them. We need to learn that from the cultures who have that rootedness. And the gospel can be part of preaching that, to bring us back to the earth, humility, humus, earth, humility.
One last question, Chris?
Bob, given the challenges that Lonergan had in his theological career and the challenges you've experienced, what do you think would be the challenges for systematic theology in the next 20 or 30 years, especially for those of us who wish to continue in the vein of Lonergan?
Yeah, okay. That's a good question. One of the things I'm mostly concerned about is that we do not fall back into the contemporary variant of the Augustinian-Aristotelian conflict in the Middle Ages. That was a conflict that was basically methodological, although they weren't able to specify it that way. Namely, that it's a question about the integration or the working together of the general, what Lonergan calls the general and the special categories in theology. The big challenge is going to be, and this was, I was nervous with the election of Joseph Ratzinger as Pope. I must confess that my nervousness may have been unjustified, and I'm much, much more happy with him than I was at the beginning. I've seen a lot of very positive things. I think his first encyclical is a beautiful piece of work and so on. So I want to say that publicly because I did express myself publicly in the other. But he is a Bonaventurian, all right? And Bonaventure is not a Thomist. And there's a thing in Thomas, and this is why Thomas got into trouble, but there's a thing in Thomas that his general categories were taken from this pagan philosopher, Aristotle. But it was nature, and Aristotle gave him the categories to talk about nature, so that he was able to integrate nature and the supernatural through the use of Aristotle as the source of his general categories, and then the theorem of the supernatural as the source of the special categories, and he had them both. Bonaventure's great on the ascent of the mind to God, but it's all special categories. Right? And so my nervousness with the present Pope was that I don't want to see theology move in an exclusively Bonaventurian direction. And that's the danger with von Balthasar and so on. I mean, I love von Balthasar. I think that the aesthetic and the dramatic is an essential component. And it's not in Lonergan heavily. It really isn't there very heavily. And that's what psychic conversion can bring in, because psychic conversion is about the aesthetic dramatic operators. But I want to see the preservation of the general categories, which now will be not from Aristotelian philosophy, but will be grounded in Lonergan's cognitional theory, epistemology, and metaphysics, and the way that they provide an integral heuristic structure for integrating the sciences. So that's the challenge, I think, that we have to be open to learning from science. The current debate, for instance, about evolution emergent probability gives you the way through that. You know? I mean, it's in chapter 4 of Insight. So.
Okay, thank you very much.
Can I just say one thing? I want to thank the people who organized this whole thing. I just want, this will give me, as long as I've got a moment on the stage. I think this has been a fantastic weekend. I want to thank you people for it. I think it's just great. Okay, thank you.